You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
My name is Tatiana Margolin. I'm seeing the most familiar faces here. I'm formerly of the Public Health Program, and now I work with the Eurasia Program. I'm liaising with national foundations and have been working very closely with IRF, our foundation in Ukraine, on supporting them in what's been going on in the past. Wow, it's been eight months now. It's kind of hard to believe. Ina Pibluska is the deputy director at the International Renaissance Foundation, which is a Soros foundation on the ground, and has been leading foundation efforts on, most mundanely, sort of adjusting the foundation's strategy to reflect the changes in the geopolitical situation, but also essentially involved in everything the foundation has been doing always, and especially since the events in the Maidan. From my sort of visual estimation, I described to Ina the crowd being representative of many parts of OSF. There are a lot of people here from public health, so Ina will make special focus on of this conversation on how recent events have impacted specifically areas of public health, but also, of course, a lot of people from the Eurasia Program, and we're interested in everything having to do with Ukraine and just other folks from OSF. So the general knowledge about Ukraine is probably more than average, but it would be good if you gave us a little bit more context and sort of shared with you what you think, what you want to share, and then we'll leave a lot of time for Q&A.
Thank you so much, Tanya. It's a privilege to be here. I did, and I'm really sorry that we have so little time. It's always so inspiring to be with colleagues, and OSF is one of the places which is quite rare, I would say, in the sense of sharing common values and common efforts, which really are great, and we back in Kiev feel that. And thank you so much for taking your time to participate in this conversation. Well, I've got a lot of things I would like to share, but probably I would like to start and maybe limit myself to three things which shape whatever we do and whatever the discussion is in Ukraine. That's the war, the elections, and reforms, and where civil society is in all of that, and where IRF is in all of that. So I will not be speaking about the military aspects of the war, so those of you who could read the news could see that we in Ukraine are experiencing the severe fighting in the eastern part, the regions which now are stricken by separatism and terrorism, which is Russian-sponsored, and there is no answer to that, and I'm really devastated to read the news. There was this week of conversation with the International Red Cross about supply of humanitarian assistance, which, or whatever is disguised as that, as by the Russian Federation, and now I just read that the convoys have moved in without having the okay from the Ukrainian government and from the International Red Cross. I don't know how what will follow then, so it's news on a daily basis, and a lot of those news are out there. Add to the problems related with the occupation, and that was the occupation of the Crimea, which was earlier, and I'm going to talk about that because it's immediately related to some of the activities which we do, and also to some of the groups which we support. So to add to that, to add to the conflict, there is political instability and there is an economic crisis. The national currency lost 65% of its value since February. Prices have gone up, utility rates have gone up, everything. Lots of people lost their jobs. So the region, which was populated by almost 4 million people, is now really severely bombed, and a lot of those people have no jobs. By the estimates of the UN, there are 416,000 internally displaced persons in Ukraine. Ukraine has never had any previous experience of dealing with them, so it's also a huge management crisis, in addition to having an economic crisis and a military crisis. Not all of those people moved to the Ukrainian territory. About 200,000 actually moved to Russia, but the remaining one, which is like 50%, in Ukraine, in different regions, and the government has an agency which is supposed to provide relief, register those people, but a lot of what the governmental agency does is provide people with the phone numbers of volunteers and just refer them for help over there. In addition to all that, we are having elections. And it's the second snap elections this year. We had the presidential election at the end of March, you know, and last month, on the 23rd of July, the parliamentary coalition ceased to exist, which by law means if a new coalition is not formed within a month, the president has the right to call the new election, which is in what he's going to do on the 24th, probably on the 24th of August next week. That will be Ukraine's Independence Day. And since then, we will have a lame duck parliament to handle all the challenges and all the necessity to combine countering the war, reforming the economy, which has been failing for more than 20 years, and responding to the humanitarian crisis, and also making sure that the new social uprisings do not really take the scale, or the social protests do not take the scale that would be really quite devastating. So where do we stand on this? A few comments on elections, why I want to talk about that. If the president does dissolve the parliament, it means that the earliest time when we are likely to have the elections will be the 26th of October, which is end of October. It will be the same law. There have been a lot of efforts from the civil society trying to change the law in a way that it's a proportionate system based on open party lists. The previous one, or the current one we have, it's 50-50. The parliament is 450 members. Part of the parliament is elected on party ballots. The other part in single mandate constituencies. The result, why this is important, is the result is that the lists are closed and the single mandate constituencies normally bring to the parliament the kind of politicians you probably would not want to see. There is very little political accountability. There is a lot of incentives to bribe voters and buy votes and then ignore whoever is left there in the constituency. And now, given that we have the conflicts and terrorists in a sizable territory of the country, I really do not know what kind of people sponsored by who and what kind of external interests may be making it on a single mandate districts to the parliament. It's extremely dangerous. So, that said, the efforts of civil society and of some of the politicians to change the legislation, make it more manageable, didn't really materialize, and now it's too late to change the legislation. Some minor changes might be made, and this is not unusual in Ukraine to start changing legislation when campaign is already in process, but still the fundamental transformation of the electoral system will not occur before this election, which means that we will have new faces in the parliament, but that does not necessarily mean we will have a better quality and a more responsible parliament than the one we have today. Good news is we probably will not have communists in, and we probably will not have the previous president's party. There are quite a few individuals which will still make it, again because of the single mandate constituencies, but the party of regions as such will probably not be able to recover so fast of all the connections with the previous corrupt and authoritarian regime. Bits and pieces of this party now reestablish itself in the themselves in the parliament under all sorts of names, like European Reform, Development, and something else. So there are at least three groups in the parliament which are bits of the former huge monolith, which was backing the previous president. And they will be doing their best to re-emerge as active politicians. But mainly the expectation is that, expectation not always, unfortunately, but the expectation of the president, who was the leading driving force behind having the early parliamentary elections, is that he will have a sizable majority in the parliament, which would be his backing for implementing reforms that he says, and we hope he means it. Jan wouldn't go into details on who is with whom and how much of percentage goes where, just to tell you a couple of things which illustrate why we're so concerned every time we have elections and why we're so concerned in general between elections. If you look at opinion polls, and there would be, like, say, Solidarity Party of Petro Poroshenko, that's the name of the president, the result would be, like, whatever, 25% to 30% of people would be prepared to vote for them. The second next would be Radical Party of the guy, Leshko, like 25-20% would be prepared to vote for them. The problem is that none of these are parties. So basically, the system of political parties is extremely weak. I mean, they formally exist, they registered as a political parties, but they are really tiny organizations. If you would like to ask who's number two, number three, and number five, you probably will have trouble, well, understanding what these names stand for. So the political party system is extremely weak. The parties are privatized, many of them actually individual-based, and once the leader is removed, trouble starts in the political party. And who populates the party lists, which are closed lists and cannot be influenced by voters, it's a big, big question. One of the areas where civil society really pushed hard was to bring in more order into campaign finance regulation and political campaign regulations. And the huge resistance followed. And it's not something new. I was doing campaign finance like 15 years ago, and the argument was the same. It's too early. And those bad guys would use anything they could find in campaign finance, irregularities, to remove whoever the good guys to have political influence on them. So basically nobody buys this argument. But the reality is that parties across the spectrum really hate the idea of having more transparency of campaign finance, which means that we again will have individuals in the parliaments who will buy their places on the political party lists. And the quality of their work can be predicted, and their loyalty can be predicted. So, not extremely optimistic about the new kind of parliament we are going to have. That said, there is a huge, massive popular demand for having this parliament out. It didn't do anything when it could during the fighting at Maidan. It didn't in any way support the citizens when they had to. It had no no lessons learned for itself in terms of ensuring that reforms go ahead, and the majority on which the current government can rely more or less securely is about 180 people. With others, to have the minimum of 226, the government really has to bargain, and we can always only guess what the bargaining involves. So it's very situational, so basically the parliament has to go. That's the full point. And now for the civil society, there is a huge and extremely important challenge to make sure that there is as much voter awareness as possible about the dangers of vote buying. There's as much information about those people who run in single mandate constituencies on their previous deeds, especially their human rights abuse record, if any, corruption record, and any other things which would make us think these people should not be in parliament. Anyway, lots of work on election monitoring, voting, voter education, parallel vote tabulation. There probably will be a huge observers mission, like previously had, but we still do not have the date for the election, so we do not know when the mission arrives. And what matters is to have a long-term observation mission. It makes no sense to observe on the day of elections, because all the violations actually happened before. I would be happy to answer any specific questions, but I'll stop here on elections and move on to the second section, which is reforms. It's just a very commonplace phrase that Ukraine needs reforms. There are lots of donors saying reforms, reforms, reforms. We have been saying reforms. There is a government reforms program which has 37 priority areas in no specific order. It's like a laundry list. But there are several areas where civil society see the reforms should be fundamentally important. One is anti-corruption. fighting corruption was the top demand of the Maidan. It was a little bit general, I have to say, because nobody objects having no corruption. So now civil society has learned the lesson, and actually I have to say in fighting corruption there have been some positive steps. A comprehensive anti-corruption legislation, it's something Ukraine has been working to, and a big piece of that comprehensive anti-corruption legislation has been pushed through the government, has been adopted. There was a significant incentive for that, and that is graduation from phase one and moving towards phase two of the visa liberalization agreement with the European Union. Everybody wanted that, so they needed to adopt this anti-corruption legislation. There was also pressure from GRECO, the Council of Europe's Commission on Anti-Corruption. There has been pressure from the EU, and of course there was a lot of pressure from the US government, which linked anti-corruption reform with the assistance, with any financial support and other support, and the pressure from civil society, which was very specific. So it's not just generally fight corruption, it's change public procurement legislation. And in order to explain to everybody why it's important, there has been a lot of efforts done by our partners, supported by REF, and I'm sure your partners as well in the field, for instance, to show to people how corruption and non-transparency of public procurement affects the purchase of essential medicines, which are paid for from the national budget. A number of cases cost twice as much as in the EU, for instance. And so they wouldn't be affordable for the people. They are really very heavily affordable for the budget. There is a huge corruption rent on them. And this is something which is being changed. Very good anti-corruption legislation has been put in place. I have to say that at the implementation level, it has effectively blocked a lot of public procurement because the system resists. And it would really slow down the purchase of essential medicines, and only due to the pressure from the civil society groups, they now are trying to find a solution, because for many it's really the issue of life and death. But public procurement is not limited to essential medicines only. It's the whole variety of things where public money becomes private money, I mean individual taxpayers' money, and this is something which we think would shift mentality of a lot of people. When they understand how much the state costs them and they pay for it, they would be much more prepared to demand at least its functions properly. There is another very positive thing which is related, and this is access to information law. Ukraine had a decent access to information law. It took us several years to have it, adopted in 2011, I think the first edition was there, and now the implementation was not something which made us happy, so in the spring of this year, while it was still the honeymoon between the society and the parliament and the government, the positive changes to the access to information law were actually adopted, and now it requires a letter from everybody sent by email by NSA saying, "Dear operator of information, would you please mind sending me how much your agency spent on this in this year?" And you are supposed to get an answer in 5 days. If you don't, well, you can sue them. Anyway, so anti-corruption legislation is in place. Enforcement is difficult because many agencies just do not have capacity in addition to will. I mean, we could speculate what's more. Is it more lack of political will? Is it just negligence and incompetence? In anti-corruption cases, it's a lot of lack of political will and vested interests. In access to information, it's a lot of lack of capacity and lack of the information as such. But anyway, some positive movements have been occurring. Well, on the last positive note, extremely slow, that's probably all what I could quote in terms of reforms. If you look at economic reforms, a lot of economic reforms actually exist in a way like we are really on the austerity measures and we need to raise taxes here, raise dues here, and relocate revenue here. Well, this is not reforms and everybody knows this is not reforms, but somehow the government persists in pretending this is what reforms are about. There is the external pressure, which is the IMF, with all the good and bad things about its impact, but at least it tries to make sure that there is some fiscal accountability, there is some fiscal transparency. Well, the social effect of increasing the rates, on especially on the poor, is still to be seen, because people already feel how that strikes their own incomes and their own incomes. But still, at least in terms of fiscal transparency, there is some commitment from the government, and they are trying to make sure that the budgets do not really go out of control completely, which is a huge risk given the rate of inflation we've got. Ukrainian economic slowdown since the beginning of March has been 6.5%. For those who remember the crisis of 2009, that was 8%. Well, anyway, we're almost there. And now, where do we start with this? I mentioned the role of civil society, and indeed, there has been an unprecedented change, which makes me extremely happy. On the one hand, it's not just NGOs which advocate for change. It's not just NGOs which are professional developers of bills which advocate them and so on and so forth. It's broader than that. They finally somehow came together and work on a weekly basis with the parliament. There is what is called the platform of reforms in the parliament, like a number of about 26 MPs, who more or less understand how dangerous it is to ignore the need for changes. So they come up with demands, and sometimes this is like changing a couple of sentences, a couple of lines in a bill, or adopting a regulation which would improve a lot of things. It's an extremely difficult work, but what makes me optimistic and what makes them optimistic is that they have earned, gained a lot of attention in the people, in the public. Politicians still listen. For just to give you an example, which may be a little bit ridiculous given what I've mentioned, like war, elections, reforms, and so on, the parliament was supposed to break for summer in early July and reconvene in mid-September. And when they announced, by the way, we didn't have time to adopt this and this and this and this, but we'll come back to that in September. There was such a massive outcry that they had to cancel vacations. Unprecedented, but still it shows that at least they do have some responsibility at least in a situation like this. I would say that is due to this. It's called the reanimation reform package. Reanimation, we were laughing about this at the beginning because it's like emergency medicine, it's medical emergency thing. When you're really dying, you need reanimation. So it's reanimation reform package. And the list is huge. They work in 14, I think it's 14, they multiply themselves frequently, action groups looking at reform of the judiciary, reform of law enforcement, reform of public health, reform of education, reform of administration, decentralization. So basically the key things where reforms are needed, and that's for Ukraine almost everywhere. To support their efforts and make sure that the supply of reforms meets the demand of reforms, actually we've created together with the Secretariat of the Cabinet of Ministers, we means IRF, a thing which is called the Center for Support of Reforms. This is to make sure that the civic activists and think tanks know what kind of areas or where there are windows of opportunity and where the government people, the governmental committees would actually be prepared to get a little bit of expertise so that they could specifically move on some areas. Again, difficult, not as fast as we wanted, but in this sense unprecedented, and we have a lot of hope for that. A couple more, just one more thing here, and this is the strategic advisory groups, which is a different creature, and this is not exactly the foundation, and this is not exactly civil society. This was the initiative of George Soros when he first came to Ukraine in March this year, and realized that this country does need a strategy, not does need a vision, but it also does need the inputs from Ukrainian and international practitioners who could have done these things like in countries which transformed themselves in, for instance, Central Europe or elsewhere. So there are very able and effective grips of Ukrainian experts, and indeed this was specifically important for us because there are lots of advisors everywhere, and advisory grips from all kinds of donors always are different in a way that they build on local expertise. And these people will remain after the donors' money ends and after there is no longer programs for support for something, but they will remain and they will engage with the governmental committees on very specific issues. So, as such, there is a strategic communication group on decentralization, strategic communication group on e-governance, strategic communication group on education, seven all in all, and one on justice and the constitutional reform. I would specifically name one of which we are extremely proud because it was formed in an experimental way somehow. It's a strategic advisory group on public health. It was created through a competitive process. The Ministry of Health posted an announcement that there is this initiative and we may have a strategic advisory group, please apply. They got about 100 applications for 15 positions, very strong applicants. So they've selected the people who did public health reforms in a situation which was also quite not so easy. Ukraine, and they are trying, well, they are not launching the process. So the ambition is to have, if not a blueprint, then at least a clear set of suggestions, recommendations, proposals for the new parliament as soon as it becomes operational, for the government as soon as, the government is ready to move on. And as a side effect of the activism or something which was proposed actually by George Soros as well, the National Reform Council has been created by the presidential office the second day after we had the meeting of strategic advisory groups, a little bit unexpected and early. And we actually thought it would be with the government. That's where reforms should be. But now, as I said, the president has decided to take a lead on this. So we are expecting this system to become fully operational and really absorb all that knowledge and talent and very specific recommendations, but also donor aid, which is available for making transformation possible. I stop here on this. And there is another thing, which is part two in our conversation. And I see I have
maybe some questions.
Questions first, and then we go to problems of public health. Okay, questions.
If nobody asks, I will take them. Anyone? You mentioned, thank you so much, Ina. I mean, it's fascinating. I think one of the things that happens from afar is that the news is dominated by the war, and so we watch a lot of the fighting, and we think that that's the major problem facing Ukraine today, but what you just told us about is all the sort of other stuff that Ukraine is still faced with, the government stuff that doesn't so much make it to the news here. So the fighting is, of course, important and one element of the issues you're dealing with, but the government reshuffle and the dissolvement of the parliament, of course, is incredibly important as well. But my question would be very sort of us-centered. If you just had to pick two things that IRF has done since the Maidan, that you think were sort of the most successful, most impactful. I mean, I know you mentioned the SAG, but maybe something that you haven't yet mentioned about, what would you choose?
Two is impossible. We've got, quite a lot of areas, and all of them are really dear to our hearts and independent of each other. What I would say is important is that, and another, again, this is another initiative which George Soros suggested when he was in Ukraine in March, is starting the regional offices to and also doing the work and helping the people who were there at the Maidan, not necessarily members of NGOs, but people who felt committed and wanted to participate, so that they would be able to participate at their local formats, so that they would be able to continue things which are relevant for their communities. Even though they may not be willing to become parts of formal NGOs and networks. So the regional offices, and these are like regional hubs for communication, information, and support of shared initiatives and shared projects, which would then grow into something big. probably attract other donors, because what we would be suggesting is just really small support in the initiatives and the meeting place. So these places will be Kharkiv, servicing the north and east of Ukraine, Odessa in the south and east of Ukraine. These are the areas, not just the ones which require a lot of attention for a variety of reasons, given the social and demographic factors and political factors, but these are the areas where a lot of IDPs moved from the Crimea and also from Donetsk and Lugansk, which are stricken by fighting now. And there will be one in Lviv, which will be working with the western part of the country. They will be working cross-country, and the idea is really to build links between people in different regions, or help them maintain those links, because many of partnerships have emerged during the Maidan in different areas between people who would otherwise really never connect. There were lots of people from different professional sectors, from small business, educators, from local governments, as well as from NGOs, students as well. And we think it's fundamentally important to keep this spirit alive and continue for these people to be able to continue, probably in a different format, what they are doing. Some are working with IDPs now. Some are working and pushing the government, local governments, for making sure that they do not forget why Maidan happened in the first place. Some are exploring possibilities for community development, whatever. But what we really want is that citizens become and remain active. And one of the positive things we've observed was a lot of self-organization, solidarity, self-reliance, and really creative attitude to addressing problems people see without relying on the donor coming and providing a grant to do something, which of course is important, and we continue to support that. But still a lot of such things emerge, and we really want people to become mature citizens, because this is after all what it's all about. I named one, and probably another important one, and I see Jonathan there, and I also know that I promised to talk about this anyway. This is absolutely, I would say, revolutionary project for Ukraine. It's about the helping OST patients in the Crimea. Nobody did that. Nobody would dare do that, I have to say. So the idea is, I don't know how much of the background you know, but anyway, on the territory of the Crimea, out of 26,000 people who used drugs, 806 were on opioid substitution therapy. And once Crimea was annexed by Russia, these people found out that it's illegal in Russia to have methadone treatment. And what the Russian government proposed, they call it the detoxification program, but basically they withdrew with the use of police and the use of drugs control agencies about 46,000 methadone pills, punished those who had them, and others were just left to themselves. So that was the project. The initiative was to provide, if not all of them, but the possibility was to provide at least some of them with the possibility to relocate to the mainland Ukraine, have access to treatment, have some funds for relocation. And it's initially for 4 months, and basically it's now coming to an end. Well, from the Crimea, we had 57 people enrolled in all this process. It's not 100, and looks. People are really afraid. I mean, there are under tremendous pressure, and all they will face criminal penalties, and they really feel that for many of them that was really not an option. But once we were unveiling, starting the launching the program, fighting in Donetsk and Luhansk began, and there were a lot of patients there as well, about 1,000 in those areas. And we now have an increasing demand coming from that part. People really want to have access to this program. So far, the program has helped 135 people all in all, out of them 57 coming from the Crimea, and the rest coming from Donetsk and Lugansk. So they were relocated to Kyiv, Dnipropetrovsk, Odessa, so several places in Ukraine. The government does provide free government-supported opioid substitution therapy, but there are still a lot of needs which these people have. And basically, the whole idea was to provide the necessary social support. We are having reports here, and I will be happy to share some of the figures. Well, some would say that the figures are not extremely large, but if you look at the very vulnerable group which we are dealing with and the very dramatic situation, you would know that if we speak about 20-plus people who have already found jobs in new places, this is something. About people who managed to come to their families and relatives and convince somehow families and relatives that they are not that bad guys and they actually require and they deserve treatment. So we do have situations where people found it very promising for themselves. The not so bright thing is that everything is fine, and this was for 4 months only. And we were trying to have the buy-in from other donors who would be able to pick it up. Well, there was a lot of appreciation, and everybody said that this is such a wonderful thing we were doing. And to be honest, I was positively impressed with the fact that we received very little bad comments after the press conference happened in Kyiv and spoke about this program. And there were a couple of patients who came and said how important it is for them. It's really a matter of life and death, because 20 people already by that time died in the Crimea because of the termination of the OST therapy. But still, in addition to appreciation, like by the Pompidou group or by our Ministry of Health or by the UN agencies, we so far have not do not have anybody who would come, great, we are picking it up, we will continue funding that. Which is sad, but still, I wanted to share this with you. It's, I think, is a very important case how urgent and timely assistance really saves life, and even if it's not picked up by others. It gives a good opportunity and a good entry point to try. With the Crimea, I think it's there is nothing we could do there. I mean, except if there are some more people who want to relocate, they will be accepted. But we cannot come in the Crimea and cannot have the OST therapy replaced, restored there, and so on and so forth. But with other regions, it's very important that the government now is aware of the problem, and people who relocate from the eastern areas have direct access to the governmental agencies, which then continue taking care of their treatment needs. So this is what makes us hope. We have got a request from the group for additional patients who would be coming from the east. Well, we as IRF do not have resources for to meet that. So it's probably something we would like to discuss for the how we handle it. And also there is another issue, which is the exit strategy. As many of these people will be socialized and will be provided with as long support as is possible, but that will probably not be support in terms of free housing and free food and anything. We will have to rely on volunteers, but there are very few volunteers who are ready to engage in this area. So it's very much an open question, and I would be really grateful if we could have your views on what solutions could be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Ina. So, questions?
Well, I was just going to ask about your opinion, just in reference to the methadone patients. In the midst of all everything else that's going on, which you outlined in the first part of your talk, what is the level of discussion that you're aware of around the impending funding crisis for methadone when the Global Fund basically stops funding that?
I think the question is about overall reduction of funding for methadone in country, not
So yeah. So in the short term, these patients
can be
located in Odessa from Crimea, and they can receive methadone services in Odessa or Dnipropetrovsk. And so much else is going on with elections and reform and war. But in the midst of all that, is there any discussion, or what is the level of discussion about the impending long term funding crisis when the Global Fund stops paying for methadone?
Well, there is no discussion, because all the discussion is now on the war, so nobody talks about methadone patients. And the cuts are not something which is publicly discussed, although the minister, there have been efforts from the patients' groups to raise this issue. How successful they were so far, I cannot really recall anything which would show that there are decisions taken already that they will cure. So the problem has been expressed. It hasn't been expressed broadly, but I doubt if we have any meaningful answer from the government there, unfortunately.
How approachable is the government right now to discussing minority rights in general? Because I mean, I worked for Human Rights Watch for a while, and we were covering Ukraine.
But this cause, what in general?
Human rights
issues.
Minority issues. Because the response we would get is that it's a war and we cannot do anything right now.
Now, in terms of discussing human rights issues, the government is, I would say relatively approachable, especially individual parts of the government. Yes, there are some which are more approachable than others, like the Ministry of Justice, surprise, surprise. But that's mainly due to the good dialogue we have with them on other areas. So we are trying, in many cases, as often as we can, also bring the human rights issues to the table whenever we talk on anything else in which they are interested. If we are not speaking about the government as the executive branch, but look at, the Ministry of Health, is more attentive than others, and it's fully approachable now, partly due to the fact that the minister himself comes from the Maidan and from civil society and from the organizations which were working in with the previous ministries within the format of the public councils, advisory groups, so on. So he's perfectly aware of this approach problem and wise. But the question is, again, elections mean we might be having new people in government. How that will affect their willingness to reform, their willingness to engage with us and others remains to be seen. We will not stop, of course, convincing them why they should be approachable, but how they react, we'll see. There is another ally in the official system, which is the ombudsperson. This is the human rights representative of the parliament, and this is our first point of call when, for instance, human rights advocates and patient groups and advocacy groups want to enact what is called the National Preventive Mechanism. It's a mechanism implemented the UN Conventions Against Torture. And this mechanism involves that there should be regular monitoring of places of non-freedom, how we call them. There's detention facilities, prisons, closed settings for treatment for special needs patients, so on. And the idea is that representatives of the ombudsperson's office are coupled with human rights people, and we actually provide specific capacity building to the vulnerable groups so that they would have their own monitors, because there is a specific UN regulated procedure of how the monitoring that gets translated into a report and how the report is sent back to the, for instance, law enforcement agency and how it's supposed to respond. So it does require training. We are doing this, and this is what we are using. And in fact, this has been, it has been working. I mean, we do not have a lot of cases yet, but at least this is where we see a possibility to push forward. With the Parliamentary Committee on Human Rights, we have a constant and good dialogue. And again, this is subject to whatever we will have after the elections. But this is not the first time we've had this. We had 19 ministers of health in the past 21 years.
Oh my God.
this is not new. And when the ministry changes, everybody changes. Institutional memory in Ukraine, it's something which is really a practically non-existent concept. So it's constantly coming back and forth, but it is not something new, and this is not something which is going to stop us.
All right.
So it's interesting that we, in this same space yesterday, had a talk from some Russian activists that are working on LGBT rights and prisoners' rights and harm reduction. And so I was wondering, is there any, you know, despite all the problems that are happening between the countries, is there any solidarity between Ukrainian activists and Russian activists about the oppression that you're both feeling?
Yes, there is solidarity, and actually, you could probably hear about some Russian people, not necessarily activists, but people who would speak. I was speaking about the OST. You know that there was a case at the European Court of Human Rights submitted by three Russian activists, and I know that many of them, some of them, at least one of them, has been getting.
You're talking about the same
treatment in Poltava, which is Ukraine, and also a lot of moral support coming from the colleagues. And we look at that as the possibility that the same path could be probably explored further. And if that is some, well, Russia will ignore the decision of the European Court of Human Rights, even though, well, it's not the first one for it. But still, I think it's significant. And it would be important to have the message spread across the board and everywhere. Well, there is solidarity and there is a lot of collaboration between people, but this is on the individual lines. I mean, and I have to say that sometimes we do have many conversations which are affected by the situation, by the fighting, by sometimes different perspectives and anything. So it's there. We would like to have it more. We well, due to the situation in Russia, we are actually not really very hopeful that the improvements there will happen and will create more possibilities for people to engage on a more stable level. Like, I don't think Ukrainian experts will be able, or activists will be able to travel there freely. This has been a problem for quite a while. But we still have Skype. Yeah.
Jonathan? Ina, I'm sorry if you addressed this before, but on a different note, I'm curious to know how the conflict and the transition have affected the Foundation's Roma portfolio.
The Foundation's
Roma portfolio.
The Roma.
Roma.
Yeah, because I know you were really building it up beforehand, and of course we know from other contexts that, you know, Roma and other ethnic minorities fare differently in transitional and hostile.
I do not want to say that it affected positively, but the work has been expanded.
Yeah.
Surprise, surprise. Probably because the Roma community has is facing a lot of changes now, is facing a lot of challenges now, especially in the East, especially in those regions which were attacked. And we did have Roma groups with which we didn't work before, who just came to us and said, we heard that you are doing this and we want to establish our own points where we would help Roma communities, which in addition to fighting have also all the stigma, have also all the attacks because of other things and so on and so forth. And we helped them to make connections with local groups working on providing access to primary legal aid, but also with local groups which were working directly with local governments supposed to be dealing with this. And again, it was not an easy process. We did hear some tensions between different groups of IDPs, including Roma IDPs, but this is not something unusual, again. So at least there is increasing understanding in the Roma community that they need to act with using the legislation and the systems which already exist, even though we know that those systems are imperfect, I mean the state, even though they know that the possibility to get financial support from the state for this and more funding and more attention is really extremely limited, but still it exists. We have positive stories, actually, in the Western region with the Roma community. That's where we have our strongest Roma community centers. We are planning to have 8 Roma community centers based in Roma community, and these will, communities, and this would be providing all sorts of things like primary legal aid,
consultations on how you deal with the governmental regulations, help if people need, for instance, passports and whatever. Mediation, like good health mediation. Then in addition to that, we want to have education mediation, and we have already started talking with the local education authorities in the areas where the Roma communities are quite sizable, so that they would have these education mediators to help teachers and to help Roma families to understand the value of education and how kids could be better prepared for being in mainstream schools, because something we are really against is the segregated Roma schools, which still exist. It's like it's de facto. I mean, it's not by law, but it's because there is a community and there is the only school there, so only Roma kids are there, which means low quality of education, all sorts you could imagine. So what we want to do is really engage with local and regional education authorities so that they would somehow work with the teachers, somehow work with the families, and that includes also the early childhood program which we engage, so that the situation is addressed. At the national level, we've had a positive development. Ukraine now has a special representative on minority rights. That's ethnic minorities, so that we understand it's not vulnerable groups, and it's not on anti-discrimination. Anti-discrimination is handled by the ombudsperson, but here it's a special representative of minorities. And the reason for creating this position was because of the Crimea, of course, and because of the massive Crimean Tatar issue, who are really under severe pressure now from the Russian authorities and from the Crimean authorities. But this person happens to be a friend of OSI, so there have been, he was very well involved in visiting Roma settlements, especially those Roma who moved to Ukraine, to Kyiv, out of the east of Ukraine, and also using his authority moved them to the regional and the local self-governance bodies, trying to see how we can facilitate very basic needs these communities have. And the situation is becoming, by the way, extremely dangerous now, not just in Roma, but in general, explaining the crisis here. There are about 70,000 people around Kyiv, not just Roma, everybody. They are located in temporary housing, like kids' summer camps, recreation areas, which means that in a month, when it becomes cold, they will no longer be able to stay there. With Roma, this is the specific challenge. They have nowhere to go. So we are hoping to get the solution from the government. There is some kind of something, temporary solution, but so far it's, the support is there, the funding is not.
I have a sort of, again, a question in a different direction. I'd like to see if you want to ask a question. Do you think hewing, like, how should Ukraine go about hewing itself? Hewing the rift between the West and the East? Or maybe there aren't these divisions there, they just appear to us from, you know, maybe even watching Russian television, or is it there? And if it is there, what do you think should happen? How can the foundation play a role?
Well, the divisions are there. Some of the divisions are indeed there because for quite a while Ukrainian government ignored the situation, that a lot of people would not have listened to them if they tried to communicate their message in Ukrainian, because people would not just understand them. And there are lots of other reasons, of course. There are lots of prejudice, lots of manipulation, including that for which many of the current members of parliament are responsible for supporting separatism, supporting that as their political base for the future. The situation has become worse after, of course, after the conflict. And I do not know to what extent those people who are running away from the conflict to the mainland Ukraine, satisfied with the way the government responds to their needs. There always will be people who are not satisfied, so it's very easy to generalize and say the government's not doing something, or it's not doing the proper thing, and so on and so forth. And still, suppose it would be perfect, there would still be people who would have grievances. a lot of people have lost houses, jobs, everything, and they would blame Ukraine for that. They would ask, why didn't you want to let us go peacefully? Like, many people thought it would be like in the Crimea. Referendum, Russia, Russian passports, Ukraine withdraws, everybody happy, or many people happy, or many people unhappy, but quiet about that. In this situation, it's totally different. We do face a lot of lost lives. We do face the problem when many underprivileged urban youth in economically devastated mining towns of Donetsk and Lugansk found an utmost social lift, which is a gun, and taking away that gun from them would be not easy. I mean, this is not something new. It happened in the Balkans, it happens in Africa, it happens elsewhere where there's the fighting, and there's nothing the state can offer to those young guys. I mean, the industry has always been destroyed. How they come back to normal, that's going to be a huge issue, and it goes way beyond whether or not they would like to speak Ukrainian or Russian. I think the huge role will have to be played by the economic regeneration. That's where international community needs to step in, and it's not just the Soros Foundation, because we will need to rebuild the country, and it's really so. What we could do is, after the fighting stops, or even before the fighting stops, number one, make sure that whatever can be helped and whatever the government could do to minimize the human rights abuse, the government sincerely wants to do, I mean, even if it happens. Number two, that those people who moved to mainland Ukraine would know where to turn for services, would know where to turn for assistance, would know that there are other people and communities willing to help, and those communities would actually be prepared for some time to accept that they are not dealing with Ukraine devotees. Many of those people would rather have a totally different solution for them. But you mentioned reconciliation. We had it as one of our plans, immediate plans, I would say, in February. And we still haven't started, because the fighting hasn't started. We haven't stopped. I mean, you cannot do reconciliation when people have their homes destroyed. But once it's over, we will start slow with support for cross-sectoral groups. I would be specifically happy to have women's groups involved, also youth groups involved, even faith-based groups involved, though normally we do not work with religious, any religious associations, but sometimes now, for instance, Caritas is doing a huge amount of work to help the IDPs and so on. How to do that? Well, we'll need to learn. Again, Ukraine has been fortunate not to have conflicts. We can learn from our colleagues in Georgia, we can learn from our colleagues in Armenia, Azerbaijan, in Africa, in Latin America. And I was talking with Akwa earlier, yesterday, during our charrette here, that it would be great to see how people who used to fight finally sit at the table. We hope rely on the nation network's resources, and IRF is prepared to take the lead there with all other donors, but how to do that, when to start, and what kind of resources will be needed, that remains a big question so far. Yeah.
Are you prepared to face
missing the beginning of
to be the devil's advocate, are you prepared to face an intervention from Russia?
We are prepared to face the integration through Russia. You don't have to be a devil's advocate. Yeah, that's like, you read the news. Well, being prepared means what? Being morally prepared. I think everybody is prepared to solutions, and we've been prepared to that since November, when we actually announced we would not collaborate with the government anymore, and then there was this Foreign Agents Act analyzing and investigation on civil society and ourselves and anything. But now it's a totally different thing, and prepare yourself morally for military intervention.
Yes.
It's totally different. Well, you know that Ukraine's got something new, which we still do not know how to interpret. In one way, it's self-organization. And another way, it's something which can be potentially dangerous. I'm speaking about volunteer battalions. They reflect what how people's attitude to that. I mean, this is not just a small minority of people who participate, but a huge number of people, including those activists, support the process. I mean, support meaning feeding them, equipping them, bringing all possible stuff which the state is supposed to be providing. Not. So the country is morally prepared, let's say. It will never be ready to stand up and say, come, of course. But worse comes to worse, I think. Well, how will we respond? That's a different question. We do not have a strategy for responding to a military invasion. When I say we mean I mean IRF. The state doesn't have a strategy to respond to the invasion. What we know is that almost all of the activists and partners with whom we worked are now safe, and we helped to make sure that they are safe in the safe places. That's as much as we could do now.
I think this, I mean, it's very heavy to think about Eastern European region sort of needing at this point a shared framework with our colleagues from other countries, a conversation on post-conflict or rather in-conflict healing, but it's definitely something that Eurasia Program is, I think, well-placed to, you know, convene or help you with if needed. It's unfortunate that it sounds like something that we will have to do and not something we ever imagined we would have to do, but it's very sobering.
I have a question that maybe will land us on a slightly more positive note.
Thank you.
This idea of the spirit of the Maidan, and you've mentioned earlier today and even just now, sort of groups that have emerged as having self-organized. Women's groups earlier, you were talking about small business owners. I think at the time of the Maidan, we got a little bit of a snapshot of sort of like the different pieces of that. And so how is it going now, whether or not we are supporting these individual movements or self-organization efforts, sort of can you name a few more notable ones?
Well, we do not support individuals. We do support and we plan to engage more through the regional regional representatives, the work with, well, it's not the legacy of Maidan, because there is something bad about the word legacy, but this the movements, the people and initiatives, many of them, we do support them specifically when they partner with existing NGOs.
But can you just talk about it?
Yes, human, for instance, there is a human rights school in Chernihiv, which the people who work with human rights would probably know. So there have been a couple of sessions already, which would invite like up to 20 people, many of them coming from the east of Ukraine, many of them coming from the non-NGO world yet, to have some general ideas on what human rights movements are, what human rights work is about, and I think this is for many of them it moves them beyond their individual activism, if I may say so. There is a special product which has been created. It's called the People of Maidan. It's a collection of about 600 oral of stories. It's of people who participated and who now looking for different ways for them to move on. For many, it's quite difficult. Many are still have this thought that Maidan was such a great experience in their life, and they cannot really stop doing what they are doing. Again, when George Soros was in Ukraine, somehow happened that one of OSF global board members was there, Viktor Shatinsky, and also one of the Solidarity prominent personalities, Zbigniew Bujak, was there as well. And he came specifically to meet Ukrainian people who were engaged very closely in the Maidan movements and helped them move post-Maidan. We call it this post-Maidan. So it's Maidan University. There are this school of civic leader, which we now have included in our strategy, so we can put some elements there, to engage these people. Saying that this is a specific project, this is something like, Well, we do have specific projects. For instance, we've supported self-organization of families of what is called the Heaven's Hundred, mm-hmm. the people who were killed during the shooting on Maidan. So it's about, it's over 100 people, because it's not only wives or husbands, also children and so on. And they now feel that the state is not really doing what it's supposed to be doing, so they found a way for themselves. They organized an NGO. So for advocating, and basically they are not advocating for their own like pensions or benefits or whatever, they are advocating for having the investigation. This is what hasn't started, and this is, if you ask me, one of my biggest problems with what the government hasn't done is that it really ignores its duty to investigate the human rights abuse which happened during the Maidan. Looks like, well, there's the ICC, International Criminal Court, but the process is long, and the Ukrainian government has allowed a very small window, which is only covering the events of November-February. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of initiative coming from the Ukrainian justice system to investigate that. So in this case, there are people who really want to make sure that these things are investigated. I could give you a lot of more examples. These are the things which fall into our emergency strategy, which the Eurasia program, thank you, Eurasia program, has been supporting. It's about whatever, how many projects? It's almost 50 projects by now. Most of them are really small, but some are bigger. The idea is really to respond to these initiatives, which otherwise probably would never emerge. Yeah.
I think we have to wrap up because Ina does have to leave for the airport very soon. But I just wanted to say a few words about IRF and sort of from our perspective, how impressed and proud we are of the way IRF has reacted and positioned itself in the conflict. And you know, of course, we're proud of the work IRF has been doing always, but it is truly phenomenal that IRF has been the place of, has taken place of sort of a place of convening, a place of, has been playing a very important part in beginning the healing process. We as a foundation, in the past several years, we have been feeling like we are no longer as responsive as we once were. We were no longer as quick as we wished we were. But I really think IRF turned it around in this conflict. And even in the way that you were able to send the money for the Crimea OST patients very quickly is very impressive and obviously life-saving. So we just want to say that from our end, we're really in awe of the work that you've been doing. And also, you know, this brown bag is an excellent opportunity, but it is such a small speck in trying to fill our understanding of the profound ways in which the region has been changed, in the way in which all of our work has been impacted by what's going on in Ukraine. And we hope that we'll have more opportunities to learn from you and with you. And of course, people have been traveling more or less, beginning to go again. So we thank you and we admire you. Thank you so much for coming and for everything that you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you so much for this. As I said, it's really inspirational, I'm sure, for all of us to be able to do what we feel is extremely important for the country and for the people. And it's so much a relief to feel that we are not alone and have all your support and have all your interest in what we are doing. And we are always there and here. Whenever there was anything you would like to see with us, question, anything, you are more than welcome. And I think, again, on a positive note, Ukraine is a case study, like a big case study, a collection of case studies, some positive, some are less positive, but we are trying to extract a lot of learning from what we are doing, and we hope this may be useful. And I'm back to Ukraine today, and hope by the time I get there, we have some positive news, not negative news. Yeah, thank you.